From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. China's rapid economic growth over the past two decades has been nothing short of remarkable. Of course, there's been a dark side to this growth. As China has built more factories, power plants, and cars, it's also become one of the most polluted countries on Earth. Air pollution masks have become so common in parts of northern China that fashion designers decorate them and sell them as accessories. The country has passed the U.S. to become the largest emitter of greenhouse gases, and a 2015 study from the research group Berkeley Earth found that pollution contributed to the deaths of as many as 1.6 million people annually. But since President Xi Jinping declared a war on pollution in 2014, China has also made big strides in tackling some of the problems. It's become a global leader in renewable energy from solar and wind. According to Greenpeace, a measure of the most harmful particulates in the air of 74 of China's big cities has fallen by a third over the past 4 years. Now, China's government is also planning tens of billions of dollars more in projects to reduce water and air pollution, but still, there's a lot that remains to be done. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at China's war on pollution. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a couple of guests who have been following this issue closely. To begin with, we'll bring in Beth Gardner. She's an environmental journalist who's been covering China's pollution issues through a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Her book, Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution, is due to be published next year. She joins us now on the line from London. Beth, welcome.
Hi, Jason. Nice to be with you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You were in China fairly recently. When you go to a big city like Beijing or other large industrialized cities, you know, as an outsider, as a foreigner, what do you notice about the pollution there? How do you experience it?
You know, you feel it as soon as you're on the ground in Beijing. I was there in February last year. Winter time is tends to be the worst time for air pollution in Beijing. That's partly because of various weather patterns, and it's also partly because people are burning coal outside of the city for their home heating, or they were anyway until the government started cracking down on that a couple of months ago. You know, I remember looking out the window of the airport, and I could barely see buildings that were just a couple of hundred yards away. I was certainly glad that I had brought my air pollution mask with me from home.
Well, tell us just briefly, how did China get as polluted as it did?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, you know, we've all seen over the last several decades this really sort of breakneck pace of economic growth in China. And the environmental problems that they face today are a direct outgrowth of that. A big part of their economy has been built over these past years on, you know, really very heavy industry, on the steel mills and the cement factories and the coal-fired power plants, the glass production. These are very, very polluting industries. And until the last few years, no one really gave very much thought to not only the environmental impact, but the health impact that all that pollution has on China's people. You mentioned 1.6 million dying every year from pollution. It's 1.1 from air pollution, 1.1 million. You know, that's an enormous toll, even in a country the size of China.
Well, President Xi declared a war on pollution 4 years ago. Just tell us briefly, what were the components of that? What has changed?
Well, you know, I think it's a reflection that the Chinese government and China's people really are sort of beginning now to reckon with this issue. For many years, as I said, there's been sort of, you know, this really laser-like focus on economic growth without much thought to the health and environmental impacts. Chinese people and the Chinese government are now really sort of honing in on that. And I think it's kind of become clear to them that the way that they've done things in the past, this very polluting path, is no longer sustainable and that the toll is too high. The biggest source of pollution, as you mentioned, and the biggest focus of this, you know, quotes, war on pollution, is coal. China consumes half the world's coal. It's an enormous amount. They've begun to, you know, sort of put caps on that, on coal burning in different parts of the country. They have unrolled the largest investment that the world has ever seen in wind and solar power. You know, so this has implications for climate change as well. And then there are a lot of sort of less eye-catching, maybe less sexy measures, but you know, equally significant. They're putting in sort of scrubbing technologies that we take for granted in the West on their power plants and factories. They're requiring that car manufacturers meet higher standards. They're requiring a higher quality of gasoline in vehicles, that sort of thing. So it's really a very wide range of measures. They've been pretty systematic about it, and they're starting to see some benefits, but there's a long way to go.
Now, China's government is not very receptive to criticism, either from its local population or outsiders, on some issues like human rights, on corruption. How much space is there for discussion of environmental issues within China?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it seems over the last few years that, especially when it comes to air pollution, the government has made a decision to do something about it. And in deciding that, they've also sort of decided that it's okay to some degree for people to talk about it. So there's started to be an opening of a little bit more space, whether it's on social media or elsewhere, for people to sort of share their thoughts, to tweet on the Chinese sort of Twitter equivalent about the day's pollution readings, or about, you know, health problems, their child has asthma. That's sort of become okay. And you can see when those things are posted on social media that they are not touched by the government's internet censorship. Anything that gets close to, you know, actually direct criticism of the government, suggestion that they're not acting aggressively enough, you know, does get some pushback. Those kinds of posts get taken down. We saw a really interesting example a few years ago with the documentary that went up online called Under the Dome by a prominent Chinese journalist named Chai Jing. It seemed to have been sort of allowed and encouraged by the government. Several hundred million people watched it in the first, I think, week or 10 days, and then it was taken down off of all the Chinese platforms. It had gone too far. So, you know, you can sort of go so far, but not, there are lines that can't be crossed.
Well,
that's modern China.
Well, one of the things I want to ask you about as well was that as China has rolled out some of these stricter air pollution safety measures, it has created some winners and losers, because some of these factories that are being closed or are forced to adopt fairly expensive pollution control measures also employ a lot of people. I understand that you've done some fairly extensive reporting on that. Tell us just a bit about what you found.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting when you start trying to unravel what are the motivations behind this war on pollution. And there are a lot of different ones. So, you know, it does seem that public anger about air pollution is driving China's action, and it's also driving this big investment in renewables. But there are other things, too. There are some significant economic concerns in China around overcapacity, overproduction by some of these big state run companies in sectors like steel and cement. There's a lot of debt involved, and there's sort of an economic risk there, and there's a need for them to kind of try to deflate the bubble without it, you know, popping precipitously, which would obviously have significant economic consequences. But it's hard to do because these industries are big employers. So in some sense, air pollution and the public anger about air pollution has provided a little bit of a political cover for the government to start to scale back. Of course, in China, things tend to sort of sometimes be two steps forward and one step back. So they'll sometimes get worried and try to do a little economic stimulus again, ramp up production. But in general, the curve has been towards kind of pulling that production downwards.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're taking a look at China's war on pollution. The country has big problems with air and water quality and is the leading emitter of greenhouse gases. But in recent years, it's taken some significant steps to address those issues. For another perspective on this, we're going to bring in Ma Jun. He's one of China's best-known environmentalists and is the director of the Institute for Public and Environmental Affairs in Beijing. He joins us from Beijing on the line now. Ma, welcome.
Hi, Jason.
Well, you've been involved in the environmental movement in China for a couple of decades. Just give us briefly an explanation. How, from your perspective, how do environmental problems affect people's everyday lives?
Yeah, the people have major concerns over the environmental pollution problem. You know, especially the parents are worrying, are concerning about their young children. taking air pollution as an example, you know, in those old days before, you know, we started monitoring undisclosed PM2.5, even during the worst smoggy days.
And sorry, PM2.5, these are harmful particulates in the air.
Yeah, tiny harmful particulates with the diameter less than 2.5 micrometers. Those are tiny particulates, more harmful than the larger ones. And even in those old days, even the very bad smoggy days, our children still need to be pushed to go out to do exercises, even long distance jogging, and increasingly, you know, parents are worrying. And after, you know, 5 years ago, from the year 2013, we began to monitor and disclose PM2.5. I think that so far, you know, at this moment, at least, you know, during those bad days, you know, alerts will be issued by the government, and people can check on their cell phones, you know, about all this air quality, and they can better protect themselves and their family members.
Well, you mentioned that people can use their cell phones to check the air quality system in China, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but that's in large part due to sort of a pollution mapping application that you and your organization have developed, which is really an amazing tool. Can you tell us just a little bit about what that tool does and how it's affected sort of the public conversation around pollution?
Yeah, as I mentioned, the disclosure started in 2013, and we trust that there's a need to help people better access this information on their cell phone, and not just the PM2.5, it's those air quality, but also the pollution sources data. We started putting that together into a cell phone app called the Blue Map app.
So the pollution sources data, this means like an individual power plant, an individual factory. You can actually get government data that's been disclosed since 2013 that shows how much pollution each one of those factories or power plants are putting into the air.
Yeah, we pushed for that in 2013. To our surprise, the government made a requirement for that to happen from 2014. So now, you know, on our Blue Map app, people can check the real-time disclosure of online monitoring data of nearly 10,000, some of the largest coal power, iron, steel, cement, chemical factories, and some of the another 6,000 water emitters. This is not just they can access this information, they can also share that through social media and tagging the official account, making that a micro reporting. So far, thousands of such a micro reporting have been filed by the Blue Map app users, promoting some more than 800, some of the largest factories to, for the first time, openly address their violation problems to the public.
Well, Ma, I want to pick up on this issue again in a moment, but I just want to broaden our conversation by bringing in another guest. Joining us now on the line from Washington, D.C. is Jennifer Turner. She's the director of the Woodrow Wilson's Center's China Environment Forum. She's also the manager of its Global Choke Point Initiative. She spent 2 decades working on China environmental issues. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for having me today.
Well, we have spent some time talking about China's air pollution problems, but as Ma was mentioning, with his Blue Sky app, one of the things that Chinese people can do is track water pollution and sources of water pollution as well. I think there was a recent report saying that as much as 80% of the groundwater in China is not just undrinkable, but unfit for human contact. So tell us just a little bit about some of the water pollution issues there and how they're being addressed.
Well, I believe that water is China's biggest environmental pollution problem. I mean, the air, the technology is much more capable to deal with it. And we're seeing positive signs with coal use going down, stricter controls in the cities on air emissions, as Majin talked about. But Besides groundwater, about 30 to 50% of China's surface water is also unfit to even come in contact with humans. Now, cities have been really good at treating their municipal wastewater over the past 10, 15 years, but unfortunately, they don't treat very much of their sludge. In fact, a few years ago, tipped off by some citizens in Beijing, Xi Jing journalists found that there were 30 mountains of sludge, maybe big hills, surrounding the city, and because the Beijing's wastewater treatment plants were simply dumping it out there and then giving it to farmers as free fertilizer.
So now, sludge, this is the byproduct from sewage and wastewater treatment plants.
Yes, I'm sorry, on your program we're talking about poop. But there's a lot of other contaminants. About 30% of municipal wastewater contains industrial wastewater as well. So it's one of those many silent polluters of China's soil and groundwater. Agricultural runoff is the number one polluter of water in China. Lots of from putting too much fertilizers and pesticides. And then, of course, there's many examples of industries not meeting water pollution requirements. But encouragingly, January this year, China's Water Pollution Action Plan came into effect, and there are much stricter penalties now on industries, very similar to the United States. Instead of a slap on the hand, as in the past, fines are higher. They go every day. And local governments, who often own a lot of these industries, are also going to be subject to not only fines, but they might lose their development funding. And this is all part of this bigger part of the war on pollution in China, is changing a lot of the regulations and incentives for the local officials.
Well, Ma Jun, if I could turn this back to you then. You were talking about how your pollution application has been used by thousands of people to report environmental violations in China. But as Jennifer mentioned, one of the complicating factors is that some of the most polluting industries are owned by state and local governments themselves. So What response is there when people document, tweet, send information about violations to the government, when in some cases it's the government itself who is committing the environmental violations?
Yeah, one of the reasons for us to develop our database and then based on that, the app, is to help overcome the so-called local protection of the polluting factories. Those type of protection often interfered with our environmental enforcement. But with the people, keep filing this reporting based on the monitoring data against those polluting factories, it actually gives some backup to the backing to the local environmental agencies to approach those large enterprises, including many of them state-owned enterprises, and then tell them that it's not me who want to give you a hard time. It's the people who, they now understand that you are not in compliance. I just want to give you one quick example. After the real-time disclosure made happen, we found that one major listed company, a big iron and steel plant, was not in compliance. It's breached the standards sometimes by 10 times. We approached them, but they told us that this is not important to them, so we can't do much. We couldn't do much, but the local residents and local NGOs keep using our app to report that to the local, openly on the microblog. Eventually, the local agency weighed in and required them to stop three shaft furnaces. This leads to a reduction of PM2.5, those most harmful fine particulates, by more than 405 tons. That's a lot of fine particles.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about China's war on pollution. We're joined by Ma Jun of the Institute for Public and Environmental Affairs in Beijing, Jennifer Turner of the Woodrow Wilson Center's China Environment Forum, and the environmental journalist Beth Gardner. If you're interested in more Global Journalist, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our video cast on YouTube. Jennifer Turner, I wanted to come back to you To talk about sort of the nature of advocacy in China, in the U.S., a number of advocacy groups like the Sierra Club and Greenpeace have had a big impact on the environmental debate and environmental regulation. Can civil society groups have the same sort of impact on that issue in China?
Well, your talk, Ma Jun, is one of the most impactful environmental leaders in China, and you've talked about his app. There's one group I want to mention that was inspired by Ma Jun's work, but more of a bottom-up approach, which links to our discussion before about local governments, how to get them to enforce policy. Green Hunan, a group in Hunan province in central China, has created a citizen science kind of initiative where there are about 500 river watchers. And these are citizens who go out every day. They pick a certain part of one of three river basins in North Hunan, and they monitor it. They take pictures. They upload information onto WeChat, an application that's used by everyone in China. And it enables Green Hunan to quickly inform the local Environmental Protection Bureau about pollution problems that they're seeing in real time. And so the provincial government and the city government in Changsha have really started to see Green Hunan and these citizens as their partners in kind of building their capacity to find out who are the polluters. And what's also intriguing to see that these kind of growing partnerships in controlling pollution, the Alibaba Foundation is supporting Green Hunan and some other Chinese NGOs to work on water pollution along the whole Yangtze River Basin. We have countless U.S. NGOs who for decades have been giving grants and building capacity and partnering with grassroots groups. And maybe to shift the conversation a little bit, there's also another important driver of potentially green change in China is opening up green financing. I mean, the central government has been encouraging the banks to kind of figure out how can we really ramp up investment in clean energy technologies. And we've seen not only the Bank of China, the Agricultural Bank of China, working with Citibank and Lawrence Berkeley National Lab on, for example, energy efficiency financing and developing the kind of tools that can reduce the pollution emissions by becoming more efficient. And, you know, there's lots of others that we can talk about, but tell me if you'd like to continue in this direction.
No, I think you raised some good points. And I wanted to ask Ma Jun as well about some of these issues surrounding green finance and renewable energy, because China has become a leader in many of these technologies. And especially since the U.S. under the Trump administration has stepped back from the Paris Climate Accords last year, which were this big international agreement limiting greenhouse gas emissions, it seemed like the Chinese government would have had cover to step back from its commitments as well. It didn't do that. Can you tell us just a little bit about why China perhaps chose to stay a part of the Paris Accord?
Yeah. I think the very reason for China to be able to sign the strategic partnership deals with President Obama and then join the Paris Accord is because we realized that it's for our own interest that we cannot carry on like before. You know, from the year 2000 to 2012, China's coal consumption got tripled, and burning half of the world's coal is a leading factor for such a serious local air pollution problem, but also a major contribution to the global climate change. But ever since China launched the war against local pollution, we have seen our coal consumption stagnated. That trend has boosted the confidence for the government to try to tackle the issue of coal, and through this process can also pursue the coal benefit to improve the energy efficiency and moving towards renewable energy and then transform our decouple our economic growth from the huge increase of energy consumption.
Well, Jennifer, you heard Ma talking about China's efforts to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. China's authoritarian system does allow it to make policy changes, fairly quickly and significantly, are, you know, perhaps more so than in the U.S., where there's, you know, more back and forth and different interest groups pushing their cases. Are there some drawbacks to how China has been addressing these issues?
Well, I mean, yes, you know, they're able to very quickly turn the Titanic on coal, and it's very encouraging, and investing a lot in renewable energy. But sometimes that investment gets ahead of what they're actually able to get online. We have a lot of what we call garbage wind in China. About some places, about 30% of the wind and solar panels are not able to get on the grid. You know, they will eventually catch up. Also noting,
so in other words, these are big wind and solar investments and power production facilities that aren't actually generating any power. They're just sitting there.
They're just standing there. But because the grid's not able to connect to them. Now, they also are encouraging, we talked about green financing. China has also opened up 2 years ago green bonds, and they're number two in the world in green bond investment. And a lot of that is for renewable energy, clean energy technologies, but about 40% is for cleaner coal technologies. And not all of that is within China. We're seeing in China's Belt and Road Initiative investing overseas, about 80% of their energy investments are going into coal or other fossil fuels. I mean, they are doing renewables, but also a lot of coal. And there are a lot of groups like Boston University and others that are making estimates that maybe China's overseas investment into coal could be undermining their own cuts domestically. So there's some tension there.
Well, our time does grow short, but Ma Jun, if you could tell us, where do you see this issue moving over the next 5 years? It sounds like in the past 4 years, we have seen some big strides in China's efforts to clean up some of the pollution that's resulted from its rapid economic development. Do you see that continuing?
Yeah, usually we see the Chinese government made 5-year plan, but this time, you know, our target is a 3-year target, because by the year 2020, there's a target to achieve the so-called comprehensive well-off society. So pollution control have been made one of the top priorities, three major top priorities. So we can see that targets are being set, new targets being set, new action plans being drafted, not just against air pollution, but also water pollution, and for the first time, soil pollution has also been put on the soil pollution control have been also been put on the agenda. So massive plans have been rolled out, but the challenges are there. But we have seen some hopeful signs, you know, with rising public awareness, changing government policy, and especially the expansion of mass expansion of environmental transparency. We can see that if we can tap into more market approach, green finance and green supply chain, I think there's a chance for us to achieve our target sooner than expected.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Beth Gardner, Ma Jun, and Jennifer Turner for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Teodora Agarici and Rosie Belson, with supervising producer Idom Kasaye. Jiwon Choi is visual editor, and Aaron Hay and Lauren Wortman are audio engineers. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.